Our next case this afternoon is case number 70606, Preston Emerson versus State. Ms. Thomas for the appellant, Mr. Tommen for the respondent. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Mr. Thomen.
Thomen, Mr. Thomen.
Good afternoon, Justice Cherry, members of the court. I'm Jonelle Thomas. I'm pleased to appear today on behalf of the appellant, Preston Emerson. This appeal presents three primary issues, and then there's also an issue of the state's claim of overwhelming evidence, which permeates all of those issues. The first issue and the primary issue I'd like to focus on, the one that I think is dispositive of the entire case, is the district court's refusal to give what I call the Crawford instruction. Dealing with the state's burden of proof on a voluntary manslaughter instruction to instruct the jury that the state has the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant did not act in a heat of passion caused by adequate provocation. In this case, we proffered that instruction. We objected both in writing and verbally to the district court's intent to not give that instruction at the state's suggestion. This issue was fully preserved. The district court had this court's en banc, relatively recent decision that was 100% on point in front of it. The district court read the Crawford decision in a way that I do not think is supported at all by the language of that opinion. I've read that opinion a dozen times. I've had attorneys up and down my hallway read that opinion to say, am I reading it wrong? Does it not say what it says? It absolutely says what we said is that the defense is entitled to that instruction. And the refusal to give that instruction here has to mandate reversal of the conviction. The state makes an assertion that there was overwhelming evidence. And the factual statement in the briefs is quite long and doesn't quite capture everything. This was a very lengthy trial with a very large number of eyewitnesses who all saw something completely different. But critical among that testimony is the fact that Bethel, one of the victims, identified the man in the red shirt, Berman, not my client, as the shooter. Junior also testified to having seen the man in the red shirt with a gun. Other witnesses were contradictory between their initial statements to the police, their preliminary hearing testimony, their testimony at trial, even though two of them did ultimately say that my client had a gun and was shooting people. One said that Berman was the one who shot the man who died. And then after he ran out of bullets, he gave the gun to my client. The testimony was all over the place. The only certain witness who was consistent throughout her testimony was Brisha, who was Berman's sister, who of course has an instant issue of bias at play, but also her testimony contradicted nearly every other witness's in every other respect. For instance, she claimed to be the peacemaker that morning of the confrontation, when in fact everyone has her being a major part of the problem. When you look at those facts...
Ms. Chernow, could I interrupt you?
Certainly.
Please, could you give me one witness who testified that Emerson was provoked or threatened at any time?
There were several...
Prior to the shooting.
That Preston himself, no. There were numerous witnesses, though. Tiffany, I believe, Delia, who testified that they felt threatened. That things had started out with the men from one group surrounding women from the other group, being confrontational, refusing to move on, that fight escalating and becoming physical. This all took place within a matter of minutes. As things became more and more heated, that's when the shooting...
Did anybody testify that Emerson was located any place other than next to his car in the stall where the shell casings were found?
In fact, Raphael did, who was one of the state's primary witnesses. He said that he thought Mr. Emerson was over by the flowers, not by the car stall.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is an area where the testimony was conflicting all over the place as to who was sitting where, who was standing where. I believe it was also Raphael who testified that Mr. Emerson was the driver of the Crown Victoria and had the keys and got in the driver's seat and drove away, which is also contradictory to many of the other witnesses. And in the reply brief, I believe it's the Roberts case, but certainly it cites to the Amok case that states the defendant himself need not be the victim of the injury that incites the passion at issue. And in the Amok case, which was back from the 1870s, I believe, in that case it was the defendant's brother and the deceased who were in the altercation. I think under these circumstances, a jury could find that this was done in a heat of passion, not done with some predetermined plan, not premeditation, deliberation, keeping in mind that these people had all been out drinking all night. It was early in the morning hours, and that this confrontation became very heated very quickly. I think reversal is mandated not just because there was not overwhelming evidence, but also because under this court's supervisory powers, there needs to be a remedy when a district court, upon the state's prompting, has case authority 100% on point that says you need to give this instruction, and then they just don't. If there's not a consequence to that decision, you're inviting the courts, you're inviting the prosecutor's office to do this over and over again.
But even in Crawford, we noted that if the evidence presented in the case overwhelmingly establishes the absence of legal provocation necessary for voluntary manslaughter, then the question would still exist about the effect of the error. The failure to give the jury instruction appears to have resulted in harmless error, depending upon how you look at the record, doesn't it?
Your Honor, I agree that in Crawford, this court found the facts to be harmless. I think the facts here are vastly different than the facts in Crawford. Here, where you've got a victim saying the defendant didn't do it, you've got everyone acknowledging that this was all because of this massive fight going on in the parking lot that came up quickly. At the point that it was proper to give a voluntary manslaughter instruction, and no one is disputing that here, I think the next step needs to happen, which is when the defense asks for an instruction on the burden of proof regarding the heat of passion element, it, according to Crawford, must be given. And that wasn't done here, despite the clear authority from this court saying it should. The state's not claiming that the jury should have never been instructed on voluntary manslaughter in the first place. It was an open charge of murder. This court has held when the facts, or there are any facts authorizing a lesser included instruction, no matter how weak, no matter how incredible, that the defense is entitled to that instruction. And in this case, we asked for that instruction. We cited case law. You know, I'm often up here on not great records, and I hate those issues, but I present them anyway. But I like this record. We offered an instruction. We objected based on this court's authority, verbally, in writing. I don't know what more could be done to say this instruction has to be given.
Can you comment on the allegation of prosecutorial misconduct and comment on the silence of Mr. Emerson after his arrest?
Certainly, and that was the second issue I would like to address. During the rebuttal argument, shortly before the jury went into deliberations, the prosecutor said, you know, the only person they couldn't talk to was the defendant, because after all, He didn't want to seem to talk to the police after that. That is a direct comment on silence. This court has held that when a comment is direct, reversal is warranted. Even if it were somehow deemed an indirect comment, again, getting back to the case of overwhelming evidence, this is not a case of overwhelming evidence. And when you're stacking up all this conflicting testimony, to ask the jury to convict someone because he invoked his right to remain silent, because he didn't talk to the police when they brought him down to the headquarters to talk to detectives, is going too far. The district court recognized that when it sustained the objection that I submitted needed to go the step farther, which, and that was to grant the mistrial. I've submitted an issue concerning guns. I think that it's very well briefed. Unless the court has questions on that, I'll submit it on the briefs. And
I think that the two errors that you've claimed would be cumulative as far as reversal.
Absolutely. And you throw in the third issue regarding the guns, and I think it is absolutely a case that there should be no confidence in that verdict and that reversal should be given on under the facts here.
What firearm evidence are you challenging here on appeal?
During the search of the home where Mr. Emerson was located, weapons were found that are undisputably not related to this case. And there was no objection at trial. There should have been. There absolutely should have been.
Was there a stipulation?
There was. There should not have been. That evidence was highly damaging, completely irrelevant. It should not have been admitted.
But it was a stipulation, and this is a direct appeal.
It was.
Yeah. You have about 3 minutes and 50 seconds left.
All right,
Mr. Filmon, for the state of Nevada.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Cal Filmon, representing the state of Nevada in the matter of Preston Emerson versus the state. I'd first like to touch upon the primary issue that Ms. Thomas touched upon, the lack of the district court giving the jury instruction requested by the appellant. First off, I think we need to look at Ricci v. State, 91 Nevada 373. It is directly on point. It was the exact heat of passion instruction that the district court gave in this case at trial. It was considered and expressly affirmed by this honorable court. That case has received no negative treatment. I think it's directly on point and it's controlling. The state submits to you that appellant's reliance on Crawford is misplaced and that the exact instruction defendant or appellant proposed in this case was the exact instruction not adopted by this honorable court in Crawford. And because of that, I believe their reliance on Crawford is misplaced. Justice Hardesty, I believe, did touch on the critical issue, the lack of provocation in this case that would make it necessary to give such an instruction that appellant is requesting. There was no evidence that this appellant was directly provoked in this matter. This was an argument out in a parking lot, several parties present. As Justice Hardesty touched upon, defendant throughout most of the testimony was placed next to a vehicle in a car stall, not directly engaging hands-on with other individuals, members of the various parties. At best, he was loosely involved, and thus the provocation needed for the requested instruction by appellant is simply not there. Also, I would point out that highlighted in the...
Counsel, what was the defense argument in closing on the subject of heat of passion? And what was your argument in closing on the subject of heat of passion?
Your Honor, I believe the state's argument was that there was not the requisite heat of passion present at the time, Justice. There was no firearms brandished, no weapons of any sort. This was a heated exchange between the parties, vulgarities, certainly not rising to the level of heat of passion that would allow for a voluntary manslaughter, lesser included conviction. With regard to the defense, Your Honor, their primary argument was not even that this was a heat of passion situation. Rather, their client wasn't the shooter. It was another shooter. And I think that is significant as well. Additionally, I believe that the state highlighted in our answering
brief. They had a fallback that it was voluntary.
They did, Justice Pickering. I believe the crux of their argument was our client wasn't the shooter.
Understood. But they argued both.
Yes, Justice.
And they're entitled to.
Yes, Justice. I also believe that
in arguing the alternative, what was the specific claim that their client was subjected to some heat of passion that would mitigate deliberation?
In justice, I can't recall the specific fallback argument as I was focusing on the crux of theirs. I would note that the state in our answering brief did indicate that there were several other instructions that also properly instructed the jury on the burden of proof by the state collectively. Instruction 4, the reasonable doubt instruction. Instruction 8, the malice instruction. Instruction 31, the presumption of innocence. And I would say most importantly, instruction 5, which tied together the state's burden of proving murder beyond a reasonable doubt with the defense of voluntary manslaughter. In moving to Appellant's second argument with regard to the overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case, I think it's significant to note that three witnesses, one of which was a victim in this case, testified that Preston Emerson was the shooter. Of note, these three witnesses came from the different parties. Ms. Brescia Phillips testified she came from the party that Mr. Emerson was with, and she testified that Mr. Emerson was the shooter. We had Christopher and Raphael from the other party that testified that Mr. Emerson was the shooter. I think this is compelling evidence because it crosses both parties. Additionally,
Didn't Brescia have a relationship with Vermin?
Brescia was the sister of Vermin and Rayshon in this matter, and I do recognize that. And that will go further to the third point with regard to the prosecutorial misconduct claim as well. What I would like to get at there is that Brescia, defense attempted to impeach Brescia quite aggressively, and I think that Mr. Cuomo's comments with regard to what the appellant is claiming is prosecutorial misconduct with regard to the defendant's silence was rather taken into context as to the impeachment of Brescia due to her relationship with Vermin, who potentially could be pointed to as an alternate suspect in the case.
How does whether the defendant speaks to the police go to Brescia's credibility in her conversation with the police? How do those two tie together?
Well, what Mr. Cuomo was trying to show was that Ms. Brescia affirmatively came to the police and spoke to them and even pointed out Vermin saying that he was there. She gave up her own brother in her statement to police, obviously pointing to Mr. Preston as the shooter. Mr. Cuomo was also making reference after the objection that this was a direct relation to the defendant's flight after the incident, that he did in fact flee, and he was ultimately apprehended at another residence that was not his own, which leads to the firearms in question that were ultimately seized. With regard to the firearms, also with regard to the overwhelming evidence of guilt, the state needs to highlight the excited utterance made by Mr. Emerson when he was taken into custody. He blurted out to the officer, "I'm not a bad guy, I simply made a mistake." This taken into context with three eyewitnesses pointing to him as the shooter that permeate both parties involved in this case, the state submits, is overwhelming evidence. With regard to the admission of evidence concerning other firearms, I believe Justice Paraguay said that it was a stipulation.
Why was it necessary? Why was it relevant?
Justice, I believe it was relevant first to show the defendant's comfort and familiarity with firearms. Not all firearms are created equal. The mechanisms, the functionality, they differ greatly.
Did that become an issue as part of trials that played out? Did that become an issue as familiarity with firearms?
I believe it did, because if you look at it, it was determined that a .40 caliber semi-automatic pistol was used in the crime. 11 shell casings were found in close proximity to one another where the state believes Mr. Preston Emerson was standing next to the vehicle when the firearm was discharged. A .40 caliber firearm was found at the residence.
But there were no indications that it had any relation to him.
Correct, which makes it even better evidence for the defense, which I believe led to their stipulation that they could argue this was a firearm. However, my client clearly didn't use this firearm. Also, I would note in the appellate's appendix, volume 7, pages 1534 through 1536, testimony established that ostensibly the .40 caliber weapon used in the crime wasn't even the defendant's, wasn't even Mr. Emerson's. In fact, the testimony was that Mr. Emerson went over to a vehicle, pulled another firearm out of that vehicle, and utilized it in the shooting, thus showing his familiarity and his comfort level with utilizing firearms. Also of note was...
Sir, how comfortable do you have to be to pick up a gun and pull a trigger?
A lot of people don't know how to even operate the safety on a weapon.
Just the fact that Mr. Emerson had some firearms, how does that... What evidence do you have he ever fired one, was familiar with it, such that we can draw that inference? But if he owned firearms, therefore, he is more likely to have been the shooter.
Not more likely to be the shooter, Justice Stiglitz. It's that he is comfortable with actually walking over, pulling a gun out of a vehicle, and utilizing it. Some people don't even know how to load a weapon. Some people don't know how to chamber a weapon. Some people don't even know how to take it off the safety, as I've referenced before. That's why this evidence became relevant. And I believe more probative than prejudicial. As I referenced before, it was actually better for defense to note that the .40 caliber weapon that was seized at the residence that Mr. Emerson was found wasn't even connected to the crime following forensic testing. This is an argument that they can make.
Wouldn't that be more... I'm sorry, sir. Please.
And they did make that argument.
Yes, Justice.
You want to comment on this, the comment on silence, prosecutorial misconduct?
And Justice Cherry, I also believe it goes back to my comments with regard to the fact that, taken as a whole in context, what Mr. Cuomo was stating was rather, he was commenting on Breisha Phillips, the attempt to impeach Breisha Phillips by defense, in that, you know, she came forward to police. She even gave up her own brother, Mr. Vernon Turner, in her statement to police, albeit not pointing to him as the trigger man, but pointing to Mr. Emerson, as did two other members of the opposite party.
But with overwhelming evidence, as you say, why would anybody make a mistake like that? Frank Cuomo is a skilled prosecutor. Why should we allow that to happen in this jurisdiction?
Justice Cherry, I believe it was a mere passing reference taken into context with the comment on the defense's impeachment of Ms. Breisha Phillips, and also a reference to the defendant's flight, which is certainly not improper after the crime.
So you think what he did was proper, is what you're saying?
I'm saying it was a mere passing effort.
Was it proper? Was it proper?
I'm not saying it's improper, sir. I don't believe it warrants reversal, and I believe it was a mere passing reference taken out of context. I can see where the concern lies. But I do believe it was in reference to the flight of the defendant and in regard to the defendant's impeachment of the state's witness, Breisha Phillips.
And defense moved for a mistrial in that situation, right?
Yes.
What was the judge's reaction besides denied? How did she instruct the jury to disregard it, or did she?
I don't believe she did in the presence. They discussed the matter outside of the presence, Justice, and I believe sustaining the objection cured the impact it would have on the jury.
Don't you think that an instruction that it was just a passing reference and should be disregarded was proper on the part of Judge Ellsworth?
I believe it can be looked at in hindsight as a mere passing reference. Whether or not it was important at the time, I would leave to the district court's discretion.
Did the defense request eliminating instruction or any sort of identification of that issue to the jury, disregard?
Justice, I don't believe they did. Also, with regard to the evidence seized, I believe it's clearly not a bad act, as appellant would suggest. It doesn't relate to any acts which implicate or other bad acts or collateral offenses for which Mr. Emerson could have been charged. Certainly no evidence was presented that he was divested in any way of his Second Amendment right by way of any sort of felony conviction or a conviction for domestic battery, something that would preclude him from legally possessing the firearms that were seized. If there are no further questions, I'll submit the matter.
Thank you, Mr. Thoman. Ms. Thomas? Why did the defense attorney stipulate to letting the weapons in? Or am I wrong about the...
I don't think there's any sound tactical reason for doing that.
And why did they not request some kind of instruction during a final argument?
This happened right at the very end of argument. The objection was sustained. It winded up. The jury left for deliberations. It all happened very fast. The judge said she did not want to give an instruction because it would have highlighted the statement.
Was that her determination or defense counsel's? A lot of time it's tactical. As a trial judge, a lot of times the lawyers will say, well, it's a tactical decision not to give a limiting instruction so as not to bring any more attention to it.
I don't believe they were asked. It all happened pretty quickly, I think.
So the defense did not ask for an instruction. Judge Ellsworth said this on her own.
Right. She said the objection was sustained and to move on, and that was pretty much the end of it. If I may, on the issue of the closing argument and the voluntary manslaughter, it's at the record at page 2524, is the defense begins the closing argument basically explaining why this should be at most voluntary manslaughter, given the escalation in the parking lot. The DAs used the example a man walking in on his wife and finding her in bed. Certainly that is the classic example of heat of passion, but it's certainly not the only time you can have a heat of passion, and that would be a jury decision as to whether the events in that parking lot that evening constituted a heat of passion. Certainly the jury was instructed on voluntary manslaughter. They were just instructed incompletely, and it should have gone that next step.
What events did the defense identify in its closing that justified asking the jury to return a voluntary manslaughter? What facts did the defense point to?
They noted that it was an argument, a fight. People were drunk, impulsive. There was a lot. They were reacting to what was going on there, that it was not a case of premeditation.
But specifically, as it related to this defendant, what was any indication that there was premeditation, as opposed to all the other people?
The argument was everything there would have been relevant to a heat of passion. And again, this court's case law does not require the injury to be specific to the defendant himself. But he's seen that the women who he's with all evening are being surrounded by the men from the other group. His friends are being involved in this altercation. It's not as though he's some stranger to this group of people. He may not be close friends with all of them, but he had been with them all evening and was certainly a part of this group.
Was there any type of instruction on voluntary manslaughter?
There was. The standard voluntary manslaughter without the Crawford language that we instructed.
And no issue of self-defense?
No issue of self-defense. No. If I may, the Retrieve decision, we addressed this in the reply brief. It in no way addresses the burden of proof issue that's at issue here. Retrieve was issued the day before the Supreme Court's decision in Mulberry. It was issued long before this decision on Crawford. Crawford is the case that is directly on point. These same instructions that the prosecutor relies on here to say you can make an inference based upon all of those instructions, those were exactly the instructions at issue in Crawford, and this court said those aren't good enough. You can't ask a jury to cobble together different instructions to make the law clear. Sorry, I'm missing my notes here. Again, I'd ask you to look at the fact that this was not a case of overwhelming evidence. Although there were three witnesses, they each had very significant problems with their testimony. Under the facts of this case, Mr. Emerson should be granted a new trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Thoman, Ms. Thomas, thank you for your arguments in this matter. The briefs were excellent. This matter will stand submitted.